Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Recent allegations of wolf abuse in the southwest part of the state has drawn attention from around the world.
I think wolves hold like a pretty unusual place in the human psyche.
A massive operation by animal rescue groups has given 10 West Bank dogs a new life in Wyoming.
So you have to adjust your levels for 10 barking dogs when we first get back there.
Eastern Shoshone educator Ivan Posey has announced a run for House District 33, which includes part of the Wind River Reservation.
You know, I'm not only a tribal citizen or a citizen of my tribe, I'm also a citizen of the county and the state and nationally.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Wyoming Public Media now brings you our daily news roundup, delivered right to your inbox. You'll read interesting stories from just down the street and around the state. Subscribe to our daily roundup at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
My name is Conrad Smith. I grew up in Kansas, but I've lived in Laramie for 18 years now. I think that the primary function of public radio, at least in my opinion, is news and keeping public officials accountable. The entertainment is available many other places, but good quality news is not widely available, and I do believe Wyoming Public Radio has the best broadcast news in the United States right now. The service public radio provides is worth paying for, I guess, quite simply. Anybody who listens a lot has kind of a moral obligation to help pay the bills.
Begin or renew your membership on our secure website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Click on the Pledge Now link. Thanks for your support.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Recent allegations of wolf abuse in the southwest part of the Cowboy State has drawn attention from around the world. In early March, Cody Roberts was fined $250 by Game and Fish for possession of a live animal. Roberts allegedly hit the wolf with a snowmobile, muzzled and leashed it, took it home, and walked it into a bar in Daniel, Wyoming. Many wildlife organizations in Wyoming and around the nation are calling for further charges, and Sublette County is investigating, but Game and Fish is not pursuing further charges as of now. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula-Inkney talks with the station's Emily Cohen, who first reported the story, and Wildfowl's Mike Kashmir about the difficulties of reporting this story and the role wolves play in our collective consciousness here in Wyoming and around the world.
So to start, guys, wolves, they're a big deal all over the Mountain West. But I'm curious, what makes wolves unique to Wyoming?
So the way that Wyoming set up its wolf management kind of system when the state gained jurisdiction of the species about 12 years ago is the state legislature set aside this area where wolves would be managed as a predator. And then kind of in the area closest to the national parks, they'd be managed as a trophy game species. So this incident that happened, if that would have happened in the trophy game area, there'd be all sorts of kind of legal recourse for Game and Fish. But the way that wolves are managed where the, I call it the predator zone, is just allows for a lot more to happen to animals in that area. And so it was just kind of like a management decision.
Perfect. And I'm going to take us all the way back to the beginning, right before this story was published. Emily, could you tell me how you learned about this story?
Yeah, I got a tip from someone who had heard about this incident, and we were both at the same event. And from there, just tried to get the facts.
Yeah, and then Mike, you made your own trip down south of Jackson here. Do you describe what it was like reporting on this story?
This individual had not been talking to reporters. And so I thought I'd try to make a pitch to talk to him and, you know, say, hey, like, I'm happy to tell your side of the story. So I went to his house. There's no one home. And then went to the Green River Bar after. While I was at the Green River Bar, like, their phone was pretty much ringing off the hook. I think I was probably there for 45 minutes, and five random calls came in from people. And at that time, the incident was really kind of blowing up. It's been very challenging reporting on it because official communication from the agencies that have investigated, the primary agency, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, has been very limited because of a statute that they believe prevents them from talking about wolves that have died.
Yeah, I wonder if you both could describe like the atmosphere. You know, what's it look like at this bar?
It's like a throwback, I guess, kind of from another era. There's still smoking, for example, in the bar, on a strip of road where there's a lot of dilapidated buildings across the street, kind of probably, I'd say, at least 50, 60, 70 years old. I got a slaw dog for, I think, $3.
Yeah, at the Green River Bar, I believe the Green River Bar is the oldest building in Daniel. It is, like Emily said, yeah, it's kind of a throwback, absolutely. Patrons of the bar, you know, they didn't think it was fair that this one guy's actions were like directing all this outrage toward the bar. And so definitely there were some comments made to me.
Yeah, I wonder if either of you guys would venture to try to put some context into the why do people care so much about wolves in this area?
I think wolves hold like a pretty unusual place in the human psyche. Just, you know, wolves were the first animals domesticated by humans. We have a very strong bond with dogs. Dogs are living with us in our homes. And so wolves are a little unusual in that way. I mean, yeah, sure, there's other animals that hold that place, but I'm not sure you can quite find another animal that we have this duality with, where we both fear and love. And I think there's a lot to that.
I think that in Wyoming specifically, attitudes toward wolves are maybe a little bit more heated, just because of the history of reintroduction. Also, certainly strong anti-fed sentiments in Western states, in Wyoming included. I think that there's still, kind of like latent strong feelings that have stuck with the species. It just seems to be inherent. They bring out just very strong feelings for and against the species.
Mike, you mentioned earlier, it wasn't very easy to get information for this story. Emily, I know you struggled as well. Could you guys explain why that is?
I think Game and Fish is really sensitive around this topic. Understandably, this has gotten a lot of blowback. You know, there is a statute that does prevent them from talking about wolves killed in the predator zone. But obviously, this is a little bit of a different situation because there was it wasn't just that the wolf was killed. Obviously, the wolf was captured and allegedly tortured. Originally, I think they were very curt with me and just trying to give very short answers. We did have an interview scheduled. They canceled the interview just before it was supposed to happen, and really haven't said much beyond that. But I think Mike can probably speak to this a little bit better about why they are being so reticent.
Yeah, I referenced this statute earlier. This statute dates to when Wyoming gained jurisdiction over wolves. There's some legislation included in that legislation that just kind of like set the framework for managing wolves. There was like a provision that basically prohibited the state from giving out identifying information about legally killed wolves. And so that has been, it's like that statute, I'd say, it's fair to say, has like stymied the free flow of information about things that are of a lot of public interest. The state of Wyoming has the position that they cannot even acknowledge that those wolves were killed anywhere in southern Wyoming. Now, they couldn't even say in the southern, third of the state. The complicated part of it is that this guy did something illegal, which on its face would like make the statute moot. But then when he actually killed the wolf, it was a legal act. And so then, you know, does the earlier thing he did that is illegal, therefore like make the statute irrelevant later when he legally killed the wolf? I think the answer to that, we don't know yet.
What's next?
I'm paying attention to like a couple things. One, there's kind of like some outstanding legal questions. So the Wyoming Game and Fish Department has come out and repeatedly said that they do not believe that animal cruelty statute applies to predatory species. But the Sublette County attorney has a different interpretation of the statute. And so there is still a possibility that Cody Roberts will face additional prosecution for animal rights violations. So that's, of course, something I have my eye on. Another just kind of thing that I'm trying to get a sense of and keep, my finger on the pulse of is just like the public reception. Like, man, early this week, I was getting more emails and texts and just outreach and seeing like it was clearly just like there was hysteria around this incident. And I'm curious, I'm just genuinely curious if that will sustain or if it'll die down and, you know, become an incident that just kind of fades into history. I really don't know at this point.
That was Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula-Ankeny talking with the station's Emily Cohen and Wildfile's Mike Kashmir about reporting on recent allegations of wolf abuse in the state. Meanwhile, Colorado recently reintroduced wolves into their state, and they're getting quite a different reception there. Months after wolves were reintroduced to the Colorado landscape, they're expanding their range and generating buzz. Thousands are tracking them on social media, and wildlife photographers are planning summer trips to see them. Could this mark the beginning of a new tourism attraction? KUNC's Scott Franz reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
Wolves don't just fascinate or intrigue Nathan Varley. They're his livelihood.
If there weren't wolves, we wouldn't have a business.
Varley runs Yellowstone Wolf Tracker in Gardner, Montana. His company helps hundreds of tourists glimpse Yellowstone's famous wolf packs through spotting scopes each year. Varley's customers come from all over the globe.
They're the type of people that not just want to see a wolf in Yellowstone, but want to see lions in Kenya and whales in the Puget Sound.
And they pay a lot to see it. Guided hikes with Varley and his naturalists start at $800. A week-long package with lodging on the banks of the Yellowstone River runs almost $3,000 per person.
The value of wolves in Yellowstone to all the gateway communities around the park is somewhere on the order of $82 million each year.
There's just something very alluring about them. It's kind of what you think about when you think of the West.
Gaylene Orr is one of those thousands of tourists who have flocked to Yellowstone in recent years hoping to see a wild wolf. But Orr had another reason to go wolf watching last spring. She's the tourism director of Grand County, Colorado, where the first batch of wolves was released in December. Or wanted to see what a growing population of wolves might look like here.
The sightings are going to be pretty rare. I mean, you think about being in Yellowstone where they had trackers and we didn't even get to see any.
Orr says she's open to the idea of eventually marketing wolves if it's done responsibly with the backing of wildlife officials, especially if packs form in the big park in her county.
If Rocky Mountain National Park decided to do that, I mean, we would jump on the bandwagon with them.
In the meantime, she says Colorado's new wolves are drawing crowds on their own. When one was photographed in January on a remote road near Kremling, Orr said the area saw a traffic spike.
It shows that people are interested.
There's also a traffic spike happening on social media. A Facebook page dedicated to tracking Colorado's wolves has grown to 6,000 people. It includes both wolf enthusiasts and critics. Are these signs the state might someday become a hotspot for wolf watchers, just like Yellowstone?
It was fascinating to go to Yellowstone, but it's a little bit different situation there than it is here. We just don't have the land space.
Stephen Krall is optimistic. He's a wildlife photographer in Cripple Creek in southern Colorado. He didn't get the close-up wolf photo he sought when he visited Yellowstone last fall, so he says he'll try this summer to see one closer to home.
I'm also just fascinated with their intelligence and their expressions on their faces and the way they live.
But in some of the mountain towns Kral might visit to look for wolves, tourism leaders don't sound as excited. Chris Romer of the Vail Valley Partnership is raising the fear of livestock killings.
It does impact our ranchers. We've seen zero discussion or impact or momentum or anything with regards to tourism.
Back in Montana, where wolves have become the stars of books and week-long vacations, Nathan Varley sees potential for Colorado to develop as a wolf-watching destination, even if it's different from Yellowstone and its guided tours.
They're just kind of this extra quality of the wild landscape that you have there. It's like, oh, we could see a wolf. We could hear one howling at our campsite.
Colorado is bracing for another wolf milestone this month. It's breeding season. And officials say they'll know soon whether any of the new wolves have had pups. Scott Franz, KUNC.
Up next, an international crisis touches Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
Coming up on Wyoming Sounds, it's New Music Wednesday with me, Melanie Nielsen. Join me for new music from Cowboy Ross Cooper, The Fratellis in Babe Rainbow, Fruit Bats, Corb Lund, and this one from Galen McKinney from the McKinney Zone. Tune in 9 to noon for Wyoming Sounds on Wyoming Public Radio. This time on The Modern West, we climb the Grand Teton exactly 100 years to the day after Eleanor Davis became the first recorded woman to ever climb it.
I really do believe courage is like a muscle.
And we do it with a bunch of women. Courage is a muscle. It's part one of our new series, High Altitude Tales. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by the Wyoming Women's Foundation.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. In the news, we hear daily about the suffering going on in the occupied West Bank. It's a crisis that touches on all parts of society, including the pets and stray animals who have been lost in the violence. An animal rescue shelter in Wyoming stepped up to lend a hand. Jordan Uplinger has the story.
You're going to be like the second or third member of the public to actually see these dogs.
John Raymer, executive director of the Kindness Ranch Animal Sanctuary, takes me to the loudest part of the Kindness Ranch, the intake area for new rescued animals. It's a large room suited for holding dogs, pigs, or even llamas.
What part are we about to step
into? So this is our intake area for all of the new dogs and sometimes occasional farm animals. This is where they come for decompression and
70 rescued dogs have been flown across the Atlantic Ocean, ending up at different shelters across the country. A taxing journey for any animal, but for 10 of these dogs, their trip ends here in Wyoming. Their destination, the Kindness Ranch, an animal sanctuary tucked into flat, grassy lands on Wyoming's eastern plains.
So you'll have to adjust your levels for 10 barking dogs when we first get back there.
Some dogs hide, some jump up and bark, but Maison, a blonde three-legged dog, perks up with joy, tail wagging. She's doing well for a dog who was living at sea level days prior. Maison and the other dogs came to Wyoming from a West Bank rescue called Daily Hugs.
Some I'm aware of, that they were feral street dogs. Some were found begging and then taken to Ma'ad's rescue.
Ma'ad is a Palestinian-American. He owned and operated the Daily Hugs Rescue before they had to evacuate all of the animals.
And he did the absolute best that he could. But then as the unrest began to escalate over there, there was power rationing, which when you're on a well results in water rationing as well.
Ma'ad eventually reached out to the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, or SPCA. Acting as a parent organization to the entire rescue operation, the SPCA contacted people like Maggie McQuain, Director of Disaster Response for Wings of Rescue. That's an organization that focuses on the placement of rescued animals in shelters across the U.S. They were a perfect fit for the job.
And we haven't worked with Kindness Ranch before, but they have a stellar reputation in the world.
That's because Kindness Ranch has worked with severely traumatized animals, like those rescued or retired from testing and research. McQuain knew the most physically hurt or psychologically damaged dogs should go to the ranch. Dogs like Susu, who retreats to her corner at the mere sight of humans. She'll need special care and rehabilitation. McQuain worked out the logistics to have them taken to Kindness Ranch.
And this has been by far the most breathtaking series of logistical decisions that have had to be made that I've ever seen in my life. Also, because it was touch and go, it was not something that any of the organizations were fundraising to do. Like, everyone just did it.
It was already a massive undertaking for staff at the Daily Hugs Rescue to prepare the dogs and their medical information for transport. Once in America, they still had the logistics of food, handoffs, and a maze of bureaucratic red tape. But in just 3 months' time, they managed to bring all of the dogs from Daily Hugs to the United States. Here's John Raymer of Kindness Ranch.
To schedule the trip to New York to be with the dogs and assess them with complications of border security and then intake through customs and border patrol coming into America, it was just a bunch of last-minute hurdles.
Ultimately, all 70 dogs have arrived at their shelters, and the 10 at Kindness Ranch are now in the hands of long-term, passionate, and experienced caretakers, like Howard Goldman, the animal companion manager at the ranch.
The rehabilitation process is ongoing. In the early stages, we're trying to get the dogs used to a routine when they go outside in the morning, getting them used to wearing harnesses and leading on a leash.
Goldman says the ranch will care for these animals as long as needed. Some of these dogs may have had too much physical or mental trauma to be adopted, like Susu. Some may spend their whole lives at the sanctuary under the care of professionals. Regardless of their status, Goldman spends his time socializing inside the cage and out in the field with each of the West Bank dogs.
One of the things that surprised me is how gentle they are. All they've been through before they were in the shelter, in the times that they were in the West Bank, and they're still extremely gentle and still very appreciative, you know, amazing how resilient they are.
For now, most of the dogs will continue acclimating to the wind and snow of Wyoming. But dogs like Maison, the three-legged speed machine, are already showing signs of trust. Goldman believes it won't be long before some of these dogs could be ready for permanent homes in Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger. Hey, son.
Earlier this month, Eastern Shoshone tribal member and veteran Ivan Posey announced that he's running for House District 33, which includes part of the Wind River Reservation. Posey is currently the tribal education coordinator at Central Wyoming College and previously served on the Eastern Shoshone Business Council. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman spoke with Posey about why he's throwing his hat in the ring.
I thought long and hard about it. It wasn't an easy decision, and it was something after I made my mind up that I decided to go. I just think I could represent our district a little better than what it's been represented now. It's a unique district because the tribes have so much unique issues associated with governance and issues that related to the state. And when I was on the business council all those years, we may not have had a good relationship with the state at times, but there are some issues that we work together on. We agree to disagree. And I think that's kind of the process now that I see in Wyoming politics is either for me or against me. And I'm not saying that across the board, but I'm saying that we see that part of politics where there's no dialogue, there's no middle ground to meet and do the best for districts or for the state of Wyoming in general. What actually helped me make my mind up was reading this last legislative budget session and seeing that there's still people that are moderate and that are willing to work together and that have the best interest of Wyoming in mind. You know, I'm not only a tribal citizen or a citizen of my tribe, I'm also a citizen of the county and the state and nationally. As the original, I shouldn't say Wyomingites, but we was here before the state was even in existence. I think I could bring a little more and a little better representation, whether it's in healthcare, law enforcement, veterans issues. I mean, I think it's a big canvas with a lot to paint on.
Given your background in education and in tribal government, what issues are you excited to focus on with this campaign platform and if you were elected?
I have a few issues that I would like to move forward, but I think, you know, education's always in the forefront, whether it's funding or what is more appropriate for our kids to learn in this day and age to make them successful. I know on a reservation, there are some aspects of cultural methods of learning. I think we even could reach out to the Hispanic population in Jackson in the Bighorn Basin and see what they have in terms of cultural methods of teaching. Veterans issues, you know, I look forward to working with the commission if I'm elected on veterans issues. You know, we host a coffee with veterans here once a month at the college, and we had a VA representative yesterday, and there were some discussions of how there were still very issues with the VA and the delivery of healthcare. And I know that's a federal issue for the most part, but I know the state plays a big part in taking care of our veterans also. Another issue I think that is important to me is just the cooperation and seeing what we could work together on.
Back in March, Navajo State Senator Afi Ellis announced that she won't be running again, opening up the possibility of a state legislature with no Native representation. From your perspective, why is it important to have tribal representation on the state level?
I think because we're the only reservation in Wyoming. A lot of times in the world, microcosm of issues that happen statewide, they affect us. And I think it's important. You know, I still personally really believe that there's a lot of education and there's a lot of voids pertaining to what regulations and stuff that pertain to the reservation. There's water issues. There's jurisdictional issues. I think for the most part, people in Wyoming, I'm not saying all of them, but some really don't know what the reservation is besides just a square in the middle of the state. And I think that's really important that we have representation to not only educate people about the sovereign status of both tribes here. If it's good for the state, it should be good for the tribal citizens also.
Looking ahead to the campaign trail, how do you hope to plan to engage community members both on and off the reservation?
I intend to introduce myself. I intend to meet with the ranchers, the people who just live outside, you know, outside the reservation. I realize it's a large district, but you know, Wyoming's a small place, so it's you know, just run into people in the grocery store or certain events. You know, we have several events that happen here at the college, and just start visiting people. You know, I want to hear what the issues are, what they think are important. And so I could be better prepared as I move forward in this campaign.
Thinking about the current composition of the legislature being very white and male and conservative, what are some ways in which you would hope to reach across the aisle and collaborate with folks?
I identify myself as a conservative Democrat. You know, I'm not far left. I'm obviously not far right, but I'm a conservative in many areas, and I think my record in tribal government shows that. Hopefully I'm a good listener, but I wouldn't have announced my candidacy if I didn't see a glimmer of hope of people working together. It's okay to disagree. That's life. but that there are some areas where there should be some middle ground, especially when it affects so much other people beside your personal decision, you know? And I think what we see coming into Wyoming, in my own opinion, is rubber stamped legislation from other parts of the country and other states. And I'm not too sure if that's good for Wyoming. And then I think Wyomingites are, I mean, for sure, we're not going anywhere. You know, we're going to be here for a long time. And but I think, you know, there's a lot of issues with our students still living in a state, with their getting educated and, as they say, the brain drain. And that's a thing that's been in the forefront for many, many, many years.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman talking with Eastern Shoshone tribal member Ivan Posey. He'll run against current Representative Sarah Penn for House District 33 this fall. Staying in politics, we speak to the House Minority Leader next. This is Open Spaces.
I'm Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, and a devoted listener to Wyoming Public Radio. When I'm in Wyoming and listening to Wyoming Public Radio, it's like another way to realize how incredible the relationship you can have between a radio and a listener is, because Wyoming is so sparsely populated. Like, you are speaking to so many people who are spread out across this broad landscape, and you're having this interaction. I kind of think of it as similar to podcasting. Like, you're putting your voice out there and you're not really knowing what's going on in someone's life, but they could be like totally isolated on their own little patch of land in this big state and feeling connected. I love like hearing people mention listening to Wyoming Public Radio when they're doing things, when they're just like out. It's them and the elements and Wyoming Public Radio, you know? So it's again a reminder of just how sacred that relationship between, you know, audio and a listener can be.
Every day, Wyoming Public Radio brings you the news, from the latest on the pandemic recovery to ongoing issues of race, climate change, energy, and the economy. Tune in for what's happening here in Wyoming, around the Mountain West, and beyond with state and regional news updates during Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered. And you can find the latest news anytime at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Stay informed with Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. House Minority Leader Mike Yin faces unique challenges when he travels from the far west side of the state to Cheyenne to work on behalf of his constituents in Teton County. Sky-high property values, a dearth of housing options for low-income workers, and a median income that's much higher than most other communities in the state make Teton County feel like another world. But Yin, a Democrat, says he's working on behalf of the whole state and its residents. Wyoming Public Radio's David Dudley speaks with Representative Yin about housing, abortion, and the potential special session that was voted down the day before the interview.
And we're here today to talk about the process of coming from Jackson, Teton County, down to Cheyenne. Can you kind of tell me, broad strokes, what does that process mean for you?
So we're in one corner of the state, and where I have to go to the other corner of the state to represent my community, but also to represent what I believe the best interests of the state are. So not just my community, but the entire state.
And what are some of the projects? What are some of the issues that you're primarily concerned with?
Housing is super important in my community, and you know, when I talk about those values of being able to raise a family in Wyoming, it's getting harder and harder. I mean, it's always been hard, I think, in Jackson, but it's getting harder and harder in every other community across the state.
What can government do to help that situation?
The question is, I think, more so, what kind of options can we give local communities to ensure that they solve the problem? And so I think that there are a bunch of different ways, and I've proposed different ways myself, right? So I've proposed with former Representative Schwartz a real estate transfer tax and being able to use that transfer tax to help build new affordable housing in our community. I think that's still a possibility, but I think that there are also all kinds. Like, for example, Cheyenne is bringing their own sort of idea, and that could be a tool that we use across the state as well. And so I think really what we're trying to create is the forum for people to bring solutions to us, and then we can determine if those solutions make sense for communities across the state.
When you say that Cheyenne has brought something to the table, what is that that they brought, that they're suggesting?
So it sounds like from the conversation that we had in Management Council that they are interested in a tax incremental financing tool, which I believe is something where you help incentivize new housing to be built by borrowing against future property tax value increases.
And can you kind of tell me, when you come here to represent Teton Jackson, what are some of the challenges that you face because of, you know, you're bringing certain concerns to the table, and they're not always statewide. What are some of the challenges you face where that's concerned?
I think it's a broad range, right? So I think people have a preconceived perception of what they believe concerns out of Jackson are. And so there's a little bit of challenges of basically trying to get an accurate picture across to the rest of the state and to other members who represent other communities on what the issues in Jackson are. And another challenge is that, frankly, that there's a lot of money coming out of Teton County affecting how we discuss issues across the state. And that becomes a concern because it's hard to fight someone who can spend a lot of money to talk about your town in a way that's disparaging to the rest of the state.
And when you talk about, you know, Teton County, you know, they generate a lot of money because of property taxes. How does that kind of funnel into the rest of the state?
I think this is one that you'll hear a lot, is that we're a recapture district. So the way that we fund schools is through property taxes, but we fund it through a model where all the property taxes kind of get funneled into the state, and the state redistributes all of that to every school district to ensure that everyone gets approximately an equal education across the board. And so Teton County is one where it pays more in property taxes than it receives in school funding or that the model allocates for its school funding. And so that way we're actually helping to fund schools across the state in Teton County. I think that's perfectly fair. I think that the ultimate concern is, does having those high property tax values make it harder for what I was talking about earlier, having people be able to raise a family in Teton County? And so it's trying to deal with those push and pulls, but then also not incentivizing those property values to continue going up, but start going in the other direction maybe a little bit to discuss how do we ensure that people can still afford to live in Teton County at all.
And out of the topics discussed this morning, are there some that you're hoping to work on that are maybe not being given the attention that they deserve so far?
You know, I think housing is a good one, but I think labor and health is actually going to be talking about maternity care and child care issues, and those again are really core family issues. But I think that those are also affected by what has been the majority party's kind of one of their platform issues, which is abortion. And that affects how we talk about both maternity care and child care, in the fact that we've passed laws that criminalize doctors that do those kind of things. And so that makes it that much harder to have a baby in Wyoming if we can't have doctors who are willing to live in Wyoming if they're at risk at going to jail, frankly. And so I think I'm glad that we have that topic, but I worry that that topic may not be solvable as long as the party platform pushes for abortion to be completely outlawed in the state.
You all have just dealt with a vote for the special session. How did that vote go as you had hoped?
I think the vote went in the direction that the body felt it should go, which is, frankly, that it didn't pass, and that was the stance that I took. Frankly, because I believe that the call for the vote was really more performative to talk about people's elections rather than talk about actual issues that we needed to solve. So, yes, I think it went the way that I wanted, but I'm also disappointed and frustrated by the fact that we burned an entire week of everybody's lives trying to discuss the issue at all when I didn't think it was necessary to even call for the special session.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's David Dudley speaking with Jackson Democratic Representative Mike Yin. The Recreation Center in Hanna is financially struggling. The small town, about 40 miles east of Rawlins, is grappling with population loss and increasing expenses. Wyoming Public Radio's Will Walkie reports on how Hannah is navigating an inflection point in the boom-bust economy, which many other towns in the region also face.
This is like a three-quarter Olympic-sized pool.
John Ostling is showing me an empty pool at the Hannah Rec Center. There's chipped paint on the walls and a diving board and slide that lead to hard concrete. Below deck is water damage from leaks, an electric panel with frayed wires, and an outdated heating system.
Right now we're scraping, you know, to get ready to paint it. Even though we may not use it, it's not necessary for us to make it look in disrepair.
Ostling is mayor of the town, which sits on open plains with a railroad running directly through it. Last year, the pool closed indefinitely due to a broken pump, and to reopen it would be really expensive.
Of course, you have the chemicals, you have the water, we pay lifeguards higher wages.
The entire rec center costs about $300,000 a year to maintain. It has a racquetball court, sauna, weight and exercise rooms, and a basketball and volleyball court that doubles as event space.
We do conduct bingo here, and we try to do some other community activities. We have rock climbing over there.
All in service of a town that, as of the last census, has fewer than 700 people. When I visited, there was nobody working out. In recent years, the rec center has cut hours to try and keep costs down, but that hasn't been enough.
And what the town has done over the years to maintain this is, actually, we haven't put money in streets. We haven't put money on other services so we could maintain this.
Now, the rec center is nearing a breaking point.
Let's get the public forum started.
In early April, the Hannah Town Council held a meeting to try and come up with ideas to make money. It's already looked into state and federal grants, merging the space with the town library, and putting solar panels on the roof to cut energy costs. Some residents had their own ideas.
Have you tried sending out a flyer to the residents in these other towns and our town saying what the prices are to draw the people in?
With all these windmills and stuff that we all got to look at, is there any way to try talking them into donating electricity to us?
Give Bill Gates a call.
But the long-term issue is there's just not enough interest. The center currently has fewer than 40 members. That's down from about 100 from before the pool closed. Revenues don't even pay for a third of the cost to heat the building. Another resident suggested renting out space to local stores.
Use that empty space for one or two other subjects.
Right. Now, remember the magnitude of money we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Every penny counts.
Pennies, we need tens of thousands, and it needs to reduce the fixed costs.
It's a tough reality for a town that once supported facilities like this and much more. Hannah started off as a company town in the 1800s. Hundreds of millions of tons of coal have been pulled out of the ground here. Val Corco Black is a longtime local rancher and remembers Hannah as a boom town in the 1980s. The school added temporary modular classrooms. There was a bowling alley, soda fountain, and movie theater.
There were people everywhere. People were spending money everywhere. Every bar in town was open. I mean, there were several places even to stop and eat, and everything was busy all the time.
The rec center was built in 1982 off the backs of coal companies and booming funds for the local government. But almost as quickly as things went well, things went bust. By the mid-90s, there were fewer than 1,000 people. Another local, Pam Paulson, says energy was cheaper to produce in the Powder River Basin or elsewhere.
When the mines started shutting down, a lot of the homes were just lifted off the basement and moved to the new location. Some of them, they just left their keys on the counter and walked out the door.
Hannah is now mostly a bedroom community for other towns or a place to retire cheap. Paulson doesn't mind that. In fact, she likes the peace and quiet, even if it's inconvenient sometimes.
And then I think the burden gets put on the citizens of the town to make up for the rec center having to close, in that they come together and be creative and come up with things for the kids to do.
Rancher Val Corco Black agrees, but would love to see more families in Hannah. She also recognizes that the town is riding the boom-bust roller coaster, like many other places.
It's just life goes forward. We just have to go with it.
People who want to stay will stay. And the work's out there if you want to work. Mm-hmm.
For Mayor John Ostling, he has to think proactively about what happens to Hannah. How does he keep a town with an infrastructure built for thousands afloat with declining revenues? A water main in town broke earlier this year, and another expensive disaster could come down the line. The rec center might be the next domino that falls.
Pretty much everyone realizes we want to maintain this because it's a landmark for our community.
The town council postponed any major decision-making about the rec center's future, but Ostling isn't putting a full shutdown on the table yet. He hopes that things will turn around. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Will Walkie in Hannah.
In an effort to improve mental health, groups of men on both sides of the Tetons are coming together to get support. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Radio now takes you around Wyoming. You'll hear about interesting stories and events from just down the street and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:04 and 4:50. You can also subscribe to our daily roundup newsletter at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Men's mental health is a big area of concern in the Rocky Mountain West. In fact, some mental health groups describe it as a silent crisis. Wyoming has some of the highest rates of suicide in the country, and the majority of those are men. There is a growing awareness of the need to support men's mental health. Groups of men are coming together on both sides of the Tetons for emotional support, in public settings and more private ones. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Hannah Merzbach went along to one group recently and brings us this report.
Eight men sit in chairs in a circle in front of a stage and bright red curtains. They're in the Pink Garter Theater in downtown Jackson, tonight's location for the third official Teton Men's Group. They're each scribbling on torn off pieces of paper.
It's as simple as that. You just write your name, which color you are, and toss it in a bucket.
The group's founder, Brian Sweat, says that color represents their level of stress on a continuum model. Green is good, while red's a crisis. Sweat says he likes to start all of his men's groups like this.
To kind of get a baseline and record the data as we move through these events. So 2 years from now, we can look back and say, hey, we were averaging somewhere yellow or orange before, and now we're seeing improvement.
Sweat, an even-tempered yogi and software engineer, tells tonight's attendees that these events were inspired by a local tragedy last fall.
Men's group came to fruition.
Just over the border in Victor, Idaho, a pregnant woman, Callie Randall, and her toddler were allegedly killed by her husband. For many who knew the couple, including Sweat, this came completely out of left field. And for him, it hit particularly close to home.
I actually lost a sister the same way a long time ago. And when this event happened, I started grieving again and reflecting on my life and asked myself a question. How would my life have been different if I had support, if I had groups of people that I could talk to, especially men, about what I was going through? And when I thought about that.
He says he saw that women often have tight-knit circles to get mental support. So why not men?
Society tells men that we have to be strong, we have to be stoic, we have to be the rock. And at least my experience is that it's not always the case. We end up getting lost and confused. And without the right guidance and support, it's very difficult to live up to the social standards.
So earlier this year, he started holding monthly meetups for men on the Wyoming and Idaho side of the Tetons. It's not therapy, but a place to be open with one another. And there's demand for such a space. At the same time, Jacksonite Will Finney, who's here tonight, was launching a similar effort.
Goal is to just like give men who maybe are less often feeling the need to like communicate about their feelings with each other, a place to do so in like a very specific, like organized group.
Benny, who has a handlebar mustache and a big, bright smile, says he and a close group of his male friends recently started gathering every other week at each other's houses to have these kinds of conversations.
Things, you know, that are happening with a partner, with work, with life, with anything along your journey. And yeah, the goal is to just like give.
So he partnered with Sweat and local comedian Andrew Munns, and they're all holding space for people at tonight's event.
People come and maybe they're not sure what they're gonna share. And then all of a sudden people start talking and like all these things come out and you're like, oh, whoa, these things that I was feeling or maybe not even feeling have like turned and morphed into something like totally different.
Finney is all about finding ways to create community outside some of the more traditional ways in the area, like in the outdoors.
There's the kind of friends that you go skiing with, friends that I go fishing with.
Michael Devine has been a consistent member of Sweat's groups.
So I think talking about more sensitive things in kind of a public setting allows for more of those, just a different level of connection that I think a lot of people don't have.
And since starting to share what he's going through, he's realized that everybody's going through similar things.
I've kind of gone through my own personal struggles and struggles with addiction. So I think for me, and I think a lot of people, being able to share your experiences in the hopes that they help someone else is also a powerful part of gathering in this way.
Back in the circle, Brian Sweat lays out the ground rules for tonight's event.
First rule, most importantly, is everything that is said in this room is confidential. In the event that there is conflict,
nobody is required to speak, but everyone has the opportunity to talk and get the group's full, undivided attention. As they begin, Sweat encourages everyone to come up with a story or issue they're dealing with.
Maybe a problem with society, maybe a problem specifically with yourself. There's pens over there. Take a moment, write something down that you want to share or would like to discuss with the group.
And with that, the group is back scribbling on scraps of paper once again, preparing to share and support each other. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Angle, our audio producer and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.